Support for 30 Days of West Virginia Music is provided by Kinship Goods, proud supporter of DIY music and the arts. Locally shipped worldwide at kinshipgoods.com. Seriously, go check them out.
I think a lot of the West Virginia music scene centers around bars. There are a whole lot of bars. You know, and on a similar note, I think that's the case to a lesser degree in like Lexington, in where like everything is centered around breweries, which is just god awful. But sorry, did I say that? You don't have to delete that. I don't care. I don't care if, you know, all of the brewery owners hear what I have to say about them.
I'm Joni Deutsch, and this is 30 Days of West Virginia Music, a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting and A Change of Tune. Throughout the month of June, we are celebrating some of the folks who are making the West Virginia music scene wild and wonderful. 30 days, 30 brand new West Virginia music interviews. And today, a noisy, lo-fi, one-man European torn machine who hails from Morgantown, West Virginia. This is Jay Marinelli. So, can you introduce yourself and what you do?
Yeah, my name is Jay Marinelli, originally from Morgantown, West Virginia. What I do, essentially, is write songs and perform them using, how do I put this, foot percussion, basically an upended drum set that consists of a hi-hat, a snare drum, and a bass drum that I play with my feet, and I play guitar and sing on top of that, and that's essentially what I do.
How did you get started playing music in Morgantown?
This goes back a really long way. This goes back to when
you're not old. You're not that old.
What?
Don't come
well,
on.
I was lucky enough to have grown up in an environment in which playing music and kind of being creative with it was encouraged. When I was growing up in the 1980s, especially like the mid to late 1980s, there was a venue in Morgantown. Well, there are a couple of venues, but the main one for me was called the Dry House, which was this ologist space that was adjacent to a much more well-known venue called the Underground Railroad, which I'm sure you've heard about, and I'm sure your listeners know of probably very well if they tune into your program. And there was a scene that, like a sort of a meeting scene that coalesced around those two venues, and the sort of ologist punk music scene was my sort of like gateway into this whole thing, which is why I'm still like always willing to play shows like that no matter what. Like, yes, you can give me, I don't know, a bottle of Dr. Pepper and $5. Yes, I will drive 50 miles and play your show because, you know, I respect what you're doing. Sure, fine. So that's essentially how I got started. I got started playing drums in a couple of bands and sort of like wanted to learn how to play guitar and sing and write songs and that sort of thing. So I kind of switched over a little bit, and I've been in through the years, I've kind of gone back and forth between the two. And then I just kind of decided about 10 or so years ago, well, why not try doing both at the same time? So that essentially brings us up to date, you know, to the present day.
Before you started playing in Morgantown, were you already listening to music? I mean, did you grow up in a musical household?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I forgot to mention that, like, before I kind of got into all the punk stuff and everything, I was in the marching band, and I think even as far back as, you know, I think about sixth grade, I started playing snare drum in, like, the school band, and just kind of took it from there. I started learning drum set around seventh or eighth grade, and I was always kind of into music, and I would go to concerts and things, like, for example, like, the first show I saw when I was 13 years old was the Go-Go's at the Coliseum in Morgantown with A Flock of Seagulls opening.
Wow.
Which was, needless to say, completely amazing. And then I saw kind of other bands like that, like, you know, kind of like 80s sort of popish new wave sort of bands, like Duran Duran played the Coliseum the next year, and I saw them. They were, of course, great. I don't know. I guess I've always been a little bit more exploratory maybe than most listeners, and the steps between the Go-Go's and Duran Duran into the Sex Pistols and the Clash, it's not really that far off, you know? So just, you know, through the help of, like, you know, perhaps the older brother's record collection or one of the, couple of record stores in Morgantown. I kind of worked my way into punk and post-punk and those sort of musics.
I've heard stories of Morgantown, in the past, that it was just such a different music scene than it is today. Can you talk a little bit about that? And because you've toured in and out of Morgantown for years and years and years. What made it so special back then?
Wow. It just seemed like you could do anything. Like, I know it sounds like a cliche, but, when I was 18 years old, it just seemed like you could play anything. Like, you would have at least a few people really, really into it, and it could get to the point where, you could put out a demo tape and, sell, 100 of them in one night. Your kind of crappy band, but you could literally do any kind of music, no matter how weird, and there would be an audience for it. Because I just think that people in that town, especially back then, were really curious, and it's not like they weren't critical or didn't have any sort of sense of quality control or anything like that. I think they were just really open to different things. Through going to shows initially and kind of hanging out with older punk people, and not only older punk people, but people like Michelle Wolford and Marsha Ferber, who ran the Underground Railroad, and Duff, who played bass in the Inbred, and all this sort of older crowd, punks, hippies, bikers, Rastafarians. I got turned on to just so much music at once. It was like some crazy golden era. And I'm not a very nostalgic person, but I do get a bit misty-eyed about that, about how fun it was and how just every week you would go to a show and just have your mind completely blown. And another thing that I kind of like to, apply to how I deal with people, especially younger people, is that all the older people were super nice. Like, you didn't have that weird jaded scenester thing. Like, or at least there wasn't that much of it. An older person found out that you were into something, then she or he would be like, let me make you a tape of this. They're like, oh, if you like, New Order, you'll love Joy Division and you'll love Cabaret Voltaire. So I'm going to make you two 90-minute tapes of these bands, and here you go. Go forth. It was much, much different back then. I can't really speak for Morgantown now because I haven't lived there since 2008. But the old days, as they were really, really fun. Does that answer your question okay?
Yeah, no, that was perfect. Oh, okay. No, that's great. Because I'm 25, so I never got to experience Morgantown the way that you did in terms of music. And I know back then, between college radio and the venues and the scene, from what I've seen and heard, it sounds like it's just totally different than how it is today for a number of reasons. I'm sure WVU plays a part in that and making it more of a college town.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, and other things too, like just the population drain in West Virginia, moving away from the cities into Kentucky, or not calling you out at all for that. That was just the first state in my head because I know you. I hate you. No, but no, seriously, I was just curious about that in your time spent. I know that you've worked a bit with Mark Poole for some of your releases, and he played a pretty big role up in Morgantown for some time with the bands, especially the Phantom Six. Mm-hmm. At the time that you were performing and starting out in Morgantown, were you interacting with him or listening to his music?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. At the time, I think the first band that I saw him in was the Larrys, which was mid-80s. That was him. For a while, Todd Burge played second guitar. Jim Clinton played bass and sang. And Wes Poole, who is actually not related to Mark Poole at all, the drums, 63 Eyes sort of formed out of that band. And that's when I loved the Larrys, 63 Eyes, especially their first 20 or 30 shows where, not many people would show up, were really amazing. Just kind of watching them sort of form and kind of becoming friends with those guys, Mark and Todd especially, And then throughout the 90s, I would hang out with Mark a lot. My first sort of interaction with him as a recording engineer wasn't even with one of my bands. It was my sister's old band, this band called Lackadaisy, kind of riot girl thing.
Oh, cool.
Wonderful band. With them coming over to Mark Poole's house and recording a 7-inch in his kitchen on a 4-track cassette recorder. That was the first time I ever really saw him work. And I was amazed at just the sound that he was able to get out of that four track. I was like, whoa. I think that might have been what first pointed me toward like recording and, you know, keeping things kind of lo-fi, because lo-fi doesn't necessarily mean crappy. I mean, it can sound good too, you know, if you work on it right. But see, I've seen Mark's bands many times. Saw the very first shows in 89, but those guys were always a complete motivation to me to kind of course, have fun and be a nice guy, but like take what you're doing very seriously.
So you are now not based in West Virginia. You've been based in Kentucky for almost a decade now. What brought about that move? Was it career-wise? Did music play a little role in that?
I'm not really sure. I think that I did need to get out of Morgantown. Like, I'd moved back, and I'd been back from 97 to 2008. But my wife had... she got accepted into the PhD program at the University of Kentucky, so that's essentially why we moved. But it actually turned out to be a really good move, because I just felt like I was stagnating in West Virginia. I was working like three jobs. I still couldn't make rent. And we're talking like good jobs, like quote unquote good jobs, like teaching jobs.
I shouldn't be laughing at that. That's not something funny I should be laughing at. But that, yeah.
It's reality. It's the reality of living in West Virginia. So, I mean, I had to get out. I was doing my best to like be active as a musician, but I couldn't really just because I had no time. And at the time, the cost of living in Lexington was actually less than it was in Morgantown, so that was like a huge bonus. That's a huge bonus for a musician, you know, for sure. But I definitely think it was a very good move.
Well, it sounds like, though, even though you're away from Morgantown and West Virginia, you're still trying to keep connections alive with the Mountain State. Is that a conscious effort, or do you think that you're just still gravitating back to getting a Mark Poole to produce your record or getting a Kinship Goods to create your cover art? Is that just something that is natural?
Well, I think that if, like, there were all these cool people doing cool things in West Virginia, I probably wouldn't go there as often as I do, you know what I mean? Like, you know, there's the scene in Huntington, which is like super active and like super supportive, and people are really enthusiastic there. There's, you know, Mark up in Morgantown. There's Kinship Goods, you know, which is not, you know, not only does Dan, you know, have an incredible thing going with his shop, but like, you know, that shop's become almost a sort of community center in a sense. You know, there are events that go on, and shows there are always so fun. I'll always go back to West Virginia. You know, I have so many friends there, and I don't know, I think there may be some sort of conscious decision to do that, and just a sort of gut instinct to do that as well. Like, I think I'm drawn to it subconsciously as well as consciously. You know, and not to mention my friend Chris Quatmo, who lives in Thomas, who has a musical project called Sea Shrine, who puts on shows at Tip Top Coffee in Thomas that are always fun as well. For sure.
If you're going to look up your name and your music on the interwebs, usually, you know, phrases like DIY rocker or like one man band come up. What's the significance of being a DIY artist?
I don't know if I'm really technically DIY. I mean, I do.
I mean, when you perform everything by yourself, I mean, it's like, it's not do it everyone, it's like do it yourself.
Right. I guess in a sense, like, you know, I do, like, with the sort of instrumentation and the delivery of songs, I mean, that is, in a sense, taking DIY to its most ridiculous possible extreme. But, yeah, that being said, I do have someone who has put out the last couple of records, you know, and I do have a booking agent, not in the U.S., but overseas. So I would call myself, I'm more like DIY-ish. I guess you could say. Of course, like, you know, I'm not Ian MacKay level DIY. You know, I do get a little bit of help. I do, you know, sometimes just simply put out things by myself. I'm totally veering from the question. Anyway, I think it's incredibly important. I mean, it's kind of like how I grew up, you know, and the whole idea of like, no one's going to do this for you, so you better do it. Like, or if you want to go somewhere, then go ahead and just go somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, if you want to play a show in California, do it. it might be a bit difficult, but like on some level it might totally suck, but like, you know, you're at least going to do it.
On a similar note, and you mentioned Kinship being this community center, one-stop shop, even more than just the clothing and prints that they make. I mean, they also act as a DIY venue. Why is that important to a West Virginia music scene, having this alternative place for music?
I think a lot of the West Virginia music scene centers around bars. There are a whole lot of bars, you know, and on a similar note, I think that's the case to a lesser degree in like Lexington, in where like everything is centered around breweries, which is just god awful. But sorry, did I say that? You don't have to delete that. I don't care. I don't care if, you know, all of the brewery owners hear what I have to say about them. But I just think it's important to get away from the whole alcohol thing. Like, I mean, alcohol is fine. I imbibe once in a while. But I don't think it's the be-all and end-all. And I think it is very closely connected to music to a degree to which I am not personally comfortable. And I like the idea of getting away from that. I mean, it's not like I refuse to play in bars. Like, I'll pretty much play just about anywhere, you know, and have a really good attitude about it. But I think it's important to kind of change the dialogue a little bit and, like, change the atmosphere a little bit. I think the crowds are a little bit different, too. Like, in a DIY sort of pop-up space, I think people are there more for the music than anything else. Plus, bar shows are always late, and you're there, like, waiting to get paid till, like, 4 in the morning, and it's always just a nightmare, you know?
Yeah. No, tell me about it. That's
yeah.
I love being able to go out and go to a show at 11 and then get back to home at, like, 2 a.m. on a Thursday. Like, that's just great. That's
good times,
just great.
Good times. Yeah.
One, two, three. The last week I took a walk amongst the industry hell. A silent stray from Witcher at the Cracking Well.
Let's talk about your latest release for a little bit. Stray Volts. Yeah, because we haven't really talked about your recent music so much as we just talked about the nostalgic past and the afterglow of West Virginia music, but your own music. Can you tell us a little bit about what the new release is about? Which, by the way, is great. I should have prefaced that by saying it is a great new release.
Oh, I'm glad that you like it. I wouldn't say if there's like a theme kind of going on around it, but when I was writing some of the songs, I was thinking about like the sort of the upcoming election, and this was like, and granted, it was recorded in like sort of early 2016, but even back then, I was still thinking about it, like songs like "The Evil of Two Lessers" and, you know, things like that. You know, the title "Stray Volts" kind of refers to like being constantly distracted by everything around you and being unable to focus. Yeah, most of them kind of center around this sort of idea, this theme of like just being completely overloaded with information, you know, and being unable to kind of focus on like your own life and evolving, I suppose. But in terms of the technical sort of nuts and bolts of the record, like I recorded it in the way that I usually do, which is just at home on a 4-track cassette recorder. You know, I mentioned earlier that I first saw one of those, you know, put to use by Mr. Mark Poole, like way back in 90, 91-ish. So I still use that. Unlike him, I have yet to evolve past the larval stage of the 4-track recorder. But, you know, did that in my basement. I had Dave Klug master it. Dave Klug out of Pittsburgh, a former West Virginian as well. He's a nice patriot. It will be out soon. It's not quite out yet. I think that Dan is kind of putting the sort of finishing, you know, crossing the T's and dotting the I's on it. I believe it's being pressed right now, so it'll be out in time for when I go on tour in late June, early July.
And you're going on tour in Europe, right?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I'm going to be going overseas.
There's not that many artists I know in West Virginia that go out and do European tours. Like, I could probably name them on one hand. And I consistently see you overseas playing music. I know you mentioned you have a booking agent who really focuses more of your tour gigs on in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Was that something that you just wanted to make sure happen, that you're touring perhaps more over there than you were stateside?
In a sense, yeah. Like, before I went over there for the first time in 2014, I'd never been there before. For one, it's Europe. It's not America, not even North America. So there's that. That's it. It was a bonus. especially now, more so. And I also just heard that, like, audiences were... I mean, audiences are really great over here, but, like, you know, I'd heard, like, over there, they're just enraptured by you. I'm like, all right, I'm going to check this out. Like, I'm going to see how this goes. My buddy who does some of my booking over there, he was in town. He's a one-man band. I went to a show. He actually played a show with Tyler Childers, which was pretty insane. first time I saw Tyler Childers and his whole crew from, like, Eastern Kentucky were there, just like, yeah. It was great. And, like, I think the next day I talked to him about it. And he's like, you know, I can help you out with that if you want. Just, like, let me know where you want to go, and we'll route something. So I worked with him on that first one. And I think with the first tour, I think he did most of the dates. I actually did a few of them myself. And the tour after that and the tour after that, it's been about half and half. But the first tour, like, I flew into Vienna, Austria. The first two shows were in the Czech Republic, then up to Germany, and then France, and then back in Germany, and it was just completely awesome. It's like the days off, like, I think I had a day off in, like, Paris. It couldn't possibly be bad, you know? I was like, oh, cool, we get to go to the Eiffel Tower. Right. Awesome. But, yeah, it turned out that audiences went completely insane. I mean, one of the shows I played, it may have been, like, the best show I've ever played in my life. And this will give you an illustration of how the audiences are. In Rosenheim, Germany, which is this village in Bavaria, like the mountains of southern Germany, before I even set up, there were people in line. I don't even know how many people deep to buy merchandise and records and stuff. And my wife's doing merch, and she's like, well, he hasn't played yet. You know, you don't know. He could completely suck. You know, and you'll regret your purchase. And they're like, no, we buy now. I'm like, okay, all right, cool. Thank you, sir. And that just turned into, like, just an insane gig. So, I mean, audiences are fun. You get put up usually in a nice, at least to me, I guess being an American sort of DIY punk artist, my standards of, like, accommodations are very, very low. So, like, anything beyond, like, a rat infested floor is, like, a total luxury. So I'm just like, oh my God, we're in a really nice hostel and there's a soda machine with beer in it. This is amazing. So crowds are great. The beer is wonderful. If you, I was just saying that I'm not terribly into alcohol, but it should be stated that, like, the beer there is lovely. Food's really good. The shows are really good. The shows pay very well. People buy merchandise. That's essentially why I'm over there so often. I think that to a degree, like, people do that in the U.S., but definitely more so in Europe. Plus, you get to go and visit castles, kind of thing. So,
have you done a gig in a castle yet? Is that on your list of things to do?
I haven't done a gig in a castle, but I don't know if you've seen, there are a couple of pictures of it, but I did a gig in a town in the Czech Republic called Šumperk that was in a cathedral / friary that was built in, like, something like the 12th century or something just totally crazy. And it was recently restored and used as a community center. That was about the closest I've come. So I've got to visit many castles, but I haven't. I've just played in the cathedral.
Well, just not a big deal.
No big deal.
And I played a cathedral in Europe to a really appreciative crowd that bought all my merch. It's fine.
It was weird. And that wasn't the second show I'd ever done in Europe. I'm just like, whoa, y'all are on to something totally different over here. Like, this is crazy. I remember just the acoustics were so crazy that my contact for that show was just like, you do not need to use any reverb, you know, or any delay. You can just play very quietly and it'll resonate through the cathedral, you know, throughout the air and the stained glass and the crazy just paintings and brickwork and stuff. It was completely nuts. Look at the way it did me in. Look at the idiot you've been.
I forgot to ask, what is Stray Volts mark as your release? Is that like 15th, 16th?
Something like that. I have it written down. I think it's like, I think it might be the 15th Jay Marinelli release, and not counting all bands I was in the 20 years previous to that. And the thing is, in like past 10 years, I've also been in other bands and have put out other records with bands at the same time I was doing the Marinelli stuff.
Not to mention touring Europe and other cool things. That's a lot. That's a lot.
It's doing a lot, yeah. And I mean, granted, it has been, like, I did start doing the one-man band thing in 2005. So, I mean, that is, I guess if you break it down into 12 years, it's not like a ton. It just kind of seems like it. I guess my secret is to not do, like, a whole bunch at once, but to just kind of stay in the game for as long as I can, you know, not burn out on it, and I'll get to do all the things that, like, you know, that I want to do.
What's one thing that you hope happens with your music in the coming years?
Definitely, I mean, I want to continue, you know, just to keep putting out records and to keep touring and just kind of, I don't know, I just want to kind of get better at it and work a little bit smarter, kind of be more efficient. It would be cool to get to Asia, to play in Asia. I would definitely like to play in Ireland more. I did a couple of shows up there a couple of years ago. In the UK is really hard because you need a work visa, but it would be cool to go there. I did kind of sneak a UK show in when I was in Ireland, just simply because Northern Ireland is the UK. So I got in a bus and I snuck into Northern Ireland and played, and then got on a bus and snuck back to regular ass Ireland. That's a term, regular ass Ireland.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it's in the dictionary. That's fine.
No, it works in Scrabble. But, you know, I just want to kind of, like, widen the net a little bit and play more. I want to keep being interesting musically. Like, I don't, like, my biggest fear is just kind of the whole process becoming less enjoyable. You know, I want to keep enjoying it. And so far I am enjoying it. And 'cause that's essentially, at the end of the day, it's about you enjoying yourself and getting something out of it, aside from I did this and I did that and I have cool indie cred because of it. Like, at the end of the day, it's about, if you're not having fun, then you shouldn't do it. Like, do something else with your time. So I want to keep enjoying it. I want to keep putting out records. I want the music to keep evolving. I want it to remain interesting, at least to me, if not to others. I want to keep traveling more. I know that sounds horribly vague. It would be cool to have enough songs to be prolific enough to put out a double album. And for me, that would make it like probably like an 80-song record, because my songs are about, you know, a minute and a half long. And just meet more people, you know, and kind of like make more connections with people. And when I say connections, I don't mean like in an industry sense, but just more on like a personal level.
That's a lot. That, you know, one person would be like, oh yeah, I just want to tour more. You're like, no, actually, I want to be better at everything, including personal fulfillment.
Yeah, well, you know, it's true, you know. I'd also like to, I don't know. I'd like to see my friends do more of the same, too. And I think that some of them will. I would be stoked if I saw, like, my musician friends be able to do some of the things that I'm doing. I don't think it takes any kind of like special person to be able to do that. I think it's more motivation, like it's rather than having some sort of magical gift. I think that music is pretty much accessible to everyone. It's just a matter of kind of like being willing to do it and wanting to do it and loving to do it and, you know, suffering for your art.
Jay Marinelli's latest release is Stray Volts. You can find his music on Bandcamp and wherever fine local music is streamed and sold. 30 Days of West Virginia Music is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting and A Change of Tune. This episode is written, edited, and produced by me, Joni Deutsch. Our associate producer is Nathan Thomas. Our digital promotions come from Josh Saul. Our theme was composed by Matt Jackford and performed by Montana Skies and John Query. You can hear more West Virginia music on A Change of Tune, airing Saturday nights at 10 on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Make sure to follow us on social media. We do a lot of cool things on there. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We are at A Change of Tune. And for even more West Virginia music chats, make sure to go to wvpublic.org/wvmusic and subscribe to our podcast feed. I'm Joni Deutsch. Thanks for listening.